Hi, folks. Last week on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick, that's me, interviewed Tina Gerhardt, a researcher and environmental journalist who observed this month's International United Nations Conference on Reducing Climate Change to Manageable Levels. The conference was captured by corporate interests, and they developed plans that Gerhardt described as kicking the can down the road. Just a lot of talk and empty promises. These promises made to avoid the action that most people on Earth strongly support, and for very good reason. Today, Tina is on the line. We'll be discussing what now must be done to maintain a habitable planet, what might succeed. Over 100 cities around the world have achieved 100% renewable energy. Tina Gerhardt, did anybody at the International United Nations Conference, including the thousands of protesters, did anybody discuss how it was done?
Yeah, the activists, there were two enormous protests on Friday and on Saturday. I guess it's 10 days ago now. On Fridays, the huge demonstration was led by Fridays for Future, which is a weekly youth protest movement that was initiated by Greta Thunberg, the young climate activist in Sweden who did not go to school on Fridays, but instead was going to use that day to protest or otherwise take action to address the climate crisis. And it led to this global movement. I mean, there's people who participate in this in sub-Saharan Africa, in the Pacific, all over the U.S. And the youth movement in terms of climate activism has been a real beacon of hope, I guess one could say, or just a real highlight of the protests. And then there's such solidarity among different constituencies that one saw. Saturday was a global day of action that was convened, and there were solidarity protests around the world. And at the head of that protest movement were indigenous youth leaders, and they led the entire march and then were on the main stage. And both of them had many more participants in terms of the numbers of people that were expected. They had many more participants. It's the, like I said, the solidarity among these different constituent groups that are also really important to note. So young, there's also old, the above 60, through Bill McKibben just founded this organization called the Third Act, which is for people who want to work on the climate crisis who are older than 60. And I, you know, would encourage your listeners to check that new effort out. The indigenous peoples I mentioned, a lot of young people, people from different parts of the globe, people representing, you know, trade unions, farmers. I mean, it's just, it's incredible to see that kind of activism on the ground. One of the things I love about covering the COPs is really seeing those groups. Or people I talk to when they ask questions about COPs, they have a sense that there's the inside and the outside. And that's true. The negotiating halls looks and feels very different than the street activism does, not surprisingly. But in terms of the politics, I think it's important to remember that many nations from the global south, you know, Pacific Islanders, a lot of the G77 member nations are, you know, I'm using UN language here, the least developed countries, a lot of what they're lobbying and agitating for is very closely aligned with what the activists on the outside are also pushing for. So, you know, the inside-outside divide, that doesn't really work entirely because there are synergies between the two. In terms of retooling, the question that you asked, also opening up for discussion a bit, you know, the sideshows to the COP26, so all of the events that involve different industries. And this was pointed out by Global Witness, there were over 500 fossil fuel lobbyists there. That was more than any single country had in delegates. So that force of the industry, just by dint of those numbers alone, is incredible.
500?
Yes, 500. Which
500.
Indeed, yeah. Fossil fuel lobbyists. And, you know, there are people who were calling for them to be banned. I mean, why are they attending? Nima Bassi, who used to be the executive director of Friends of the Earth International, he's an environmental activist from Nigeria. He said, you know, having them at this conference is kind of like inviting the alcohol industry to an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. It doesn't make any sense. I was at a press briefing where one of the journalists asked some members of different delegates, I think they were asking the COP president, Alok Sharma, actually. They said, you know, members of the lobby and oil lobby industry don't quite feel comfortable here. Do you have any comment on that? Oh, shucks, they feel uncomfortable. Okay. So that's a really big problem. And I think the other thing in terms of while we're talking about fossil fuels, if I didn't mention this in the opening, I think it's really important for your listeners to know that the U.S. does not have to include the emissions of its military in its annual emissions budget. Now, that is a huge problem because the military is among the largest, if not the largest emitter of anything in the U.S. I still have to parse those numbers, but, you know, I look for the points of action, right? Like, what action can we take, whether we're journalists or whether, you know, your listeners are activists or whether they're involved with policy reform or what have you? And that, I think, really needs to change. But to come back to your question about different industries that were there, such as solar panels, wind turbines, I unfortunately, in covering the events that were going on with the negotiations themselves, did not also have time to visit or track the sideshows that were going on in terms of the different industries that were there with the representatives. I think solar and wind are hugely important. Bill McKibben in his article last week said that the push to phase out fossil fuel subsidies certainly won't stop, and he said it's already having an effect, and he cited this article that was published by Bloomberg last week that said that the cost for the fossil fuel industry now is 4 to 6 times what it was a decade ago, 4 to 6 times more expensive to develop, to extract. And it used to be on par with renewables. Renewables have gotten much cheaper. Fossil fuels have gotten much more expensive. And I think this movement that's afoot to really encourage retirement pensions, universities, you know, go on down a list, really push entities to make sure that their investments are out of fossil fuels. And then this increasing expense of the fossil fuel industry, I think that's really had an impact on their bottom line. And I think that's going to keep going. My interests are really, and I sense yours are too, are really about how do we retool the grid if renewables have become much more affordable, and if we have these plans going through in the U.S., I'm really curious what that could look like and what kinds of opportunities that could open up. The energy efficiency, which I think for people in the West is a really interesting one, all in the up and down the West Coast, just making your homes more energy efficient. But that's, I don't want to individualize the problem. I think it needs a systemic solution too.
This is Bill Resnick of the Old Mole on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, talking to Tina Gerhardt, an environmental journalist, discussing what must be done to reduce climate change to manageable levels. Tina just pointed out we need a systemic solution. I wholeheartedly agree. You know, we have to change our energy system very radically and quickly build out a renewable clean energy network, replace all fossil fuel burning, and do it real quickly. You know, my sense of it is that we have to change our energy system very radically. We cannot rely on the investor-owned utilities to do that. Their program would be vastly expensive, require a huge national grid cutting through the countryside. Furthermore, they're committed to producing as much energy as the economy needs, and they have no idea of what it would mean to actually have energy conservation and use reduction, which it seems to me if we only have 8 years or even 18, the only way we could possibly succeed is if we've, at least the United States, reached levels of energy use that the Europeans, that the average European has. We use twice as much energy, and it's not just because we have to travel in cars further. Although that's one of the factors, we have to begin thinking about what so many people are talking about, the energy democracy movement is moving towards local generation by local utilities, and local means cities, sometimes counties, sometimes in not densely populated areas, maybe whole very large regions, developing their own energy supplies. The sun and the wind are everywhere and can be efficiently used even in cold climates, even in places like Germany, which has gone a long way, or Oregon, that has a lot of cloud cover. Local energy can be built out quickly. You can get the materials right off the shelf. It can be done by local labor. It's not really require vast skills or highly professional engineering as the continent-spanning grid would and the investor-owned utilities depend on. If we really are serious about doing anything, we have to begin with the energy economy. The companies have no interest in reducing use They want to increase use. They want to increase consumption. Unfortunately, the Chinese, they have adopted the American dream. And if we allow the corporate sector, even the ones who are ready to use sun and wind energy, but slowly they don't want to strand their assets. And that's why the phase out of fossil fuels is so attractive to them. Yes, let's phase them out. 40 years, 60 years, we'll phase them out. And they're perfectly happy with that, with the phase out. In fact, that's part of their strategy, is to phase out while building up slowly so that they can just maintain their system of they make great profits and live lavishly. And the people, you know, get to live in bigger homes and cars, except for the bottom 50% who suffer a lot, but we don't worry about them. It seems to me that capitalism has birthed these industries who are now dominant in politics and that are actively trying to sabotage what should be going on, which is this new energy system and really different ways of life that don't require that much energy. A way of life, though, that gives you a lot more time for creative work and dancing, if you like. There's a lot of, at least used to be a lot of work on, what would an alternative culture look like? Barbara Ehrenreich's book, what was it called?
When you mentioned dancing, of course, If I Can't Dance, I Don't Want to Be in Your Revolution by Emma Goldman, that came to mind. But you're thinking of Barbara Ehrenreich dancing in the streets, maybe? Dancing in the streets?
Oh, yes, dancing in the streets, yeah.
Picking up on your points, I mean, I think what you mentioned at the very outset, the profit motive of the energy industry, well, you started even before that, and I should start one step back. You mentioned the discrepancies in energy consumption between, for example, the EU and the U.S., and I've spent some time reading up on this. So I actually came to working on the environment, not through the climate crisis. My aunt was one of the co-founders of the Green Party in the 80s, and I grew up seeing that in Germany and then started working to decommission military bases in the Bay Area and also worked on the Nevada test site a bit, which was really, you know, the underground detonations there. Nuclear tests were really impacting the indigenous communities in the area, as well as other residents. So those are the kinds of things I was doing in the late 80s, early 90s, and I'm dating myself there, that predate this climate coverage. But to come back to those discrepancies in energy emissions, I read up on them a bit, and a lot of them have to do with the energy efficiency of buildings. So we're talking really humble, modest things like insulation from the roof down, because the roof is the most important place to do it. We're talking about the way that energy systems work within buildings. So I'm talking there instead of, you know, leaky gas, which is also a health risk inside buildings, using electricity. I'm thinking of caulking. You know, all of these things are really very mundane and very humble and modest, but they're very important. And then there's, you know, the amount of energy that, say, stoves use, the amount of energy that fridges use, any of these large appliances, washing machines, energy standards on a national level there, which could be regulated by policy, would go a long way to reducing the amount of energy that we use in our homes. But I think what you said after that is something that I'm also keenly interested in, which is how are we going to retool the grid and how does that mesh with a profit motivated industry? And, you know, in California, where, you know, San Francisco for me is home, the Pacific gas and electric industry is just, PG&E is just, I mean, I can't even start talking about it because then I wouldn't be able to stop. I mean, the profit motive there is just writ large. The amount of lawsuits against PG&E for being responsible for starting some of the fires that happened in years past and the amount that they had to pay with charges of manslaughter, I think they just take that into account in terms of their balancing the ledgers. And they're like, well, we had to pay that much out, but here's how much we made in profits. It's appalling to me. And retooling the energy grid is, I think, really important. There's two books I would really recommend to your readers. One is by Shalonda Baker, and it's published by Island Press, and the title of it is Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to Energy. And what she did is to the energy transition. She spent time in different communities. She grew up in Port Arthur, Texas, which is one of the three areas that has worst air qualities because of the oil industry, aside from New Orleans and Houston. she really spent a lot of time thinking about both her family history. Her father worked in this industry and passed young due to cancer, and then other family members also had health effects. She was thinking about her family history together with her work. She's an environmental lawyer, working with different communities in Hawaii and also in Oaxaca, and thinking about how renewable energy is implemented and who has access and control. And, you know, a lot of these energy grids do have seats where people can run for office. So if people know a lot or people are retired and they want to learn a lot, they have the time, they want to, you know, really get involved with this and become informed and then run for one of these public office seats, there's nothing that prevents people from doing that. If people don't want to go to that level, they have public meetings. There's nothing that prevents people from going to these meetings and making their voices and opinions heard. I know here in New York, they just decided to not build two power plants in the New York City area because of the position of Princeton. They shut down two power plants. It prevented them from being built because New York, the state, said if we build them, they will not hold us to our state-level greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets. And I forget off the top of my head right now what they are. But, you know, your listeners could look up, like, does your state have those kinds of targets? And then if there are plans to build a new power plant or to keep one open, those are arguments that could be used. People should also look at what, if they're planned, what communities they would be located in. If they're open, what communities they're in. Because there are often environmental justice issues in terms of where those power plants are located. They're very often located near poor black and brown communities. So that would be a reason, too, to shut them down. And then the other book I would recommend is a book by Leah Stokes. She is a professor of energy policy at University of California at Santa Barbara, also very, very knowledgeable on the issue of energy policy. And her book is Short-Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups in the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the U.S. Again, that's Short-Circuiting Policy. And she's just terrific. Both of these are just terrific speakers, and the kinds of things that they advocate in their writing are just really great food for thought. I think in terms of directions to take things coming out of COP26, these kinds of local efforts that we were just getting involved with your local community and energy policy in particular, I think that's a really good place to look. I do think that the activism is going to shift back to people's countries and local communities. But one thing I think is really important to know, if your listeners are, you know, listening to this show from somewhere in the global north, the actions that we take in the global north have an impact in the global south. So when we hear about the situations of frontline communities on a global level, be they, you know, low-lying Pacific Island atolls, or be they people who are suffering drought in Kenya or other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, I think it's really important to keep in mind that we're all connected. The actions that we take here not only help us in our communities, they also have an effect elsewhere.
Tina Gearhart, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Yes, you too.